Hello and welcome to Who Goes There, the biographical game that looks at famous people through history and the histories of famous people. Let's meet the teams. Joining team captain Francis Wheen this week is the well-known columnist Miles Kington. And facing them, eager for the fray, there's team captain Fred Housko, who's joined by another well-known columnist, Polly Toynbee. Just a quick note about the scoring. 2 points for a correct answer, 1 for getting close, and bonus points at my discretion for outstanding guesswork. If you're all happy with that, let's get on with the show. We can move to round one, which is our archive round. We'll play you recordings of famous people speaking on issues that might or might not usually concern them, and all you have to do is work out who's talking. So, Francis, who's describing a job interview here?
When I got the first interview with Mr. Sam Briskin, I says, "Now, what did you send me for?" And he said, "To ask you to direct a picture." I said, "It wasn't your last picture. Didn't do so well, did it?" So I said, "What was my last picture?" Well, he didn't know, of course, and that was his opening line with everybody, you know. And so.
So, who was that director trying to get a job?
Well, my colleague here thinks it might have been Billy Wilder.
No.
But my colleague is wrong. The good thing about this, about
not because it's not his question,
is that I can blame all the mistakes on Miles, since I haven't the faintest idea. It's obviously a film director of some kind.
You're trying to think of a second film director other than Billy Wilder.
Well, all the others don't seem to quite fit. I mean, it's clearly not Orson Welles. It's some...
He once helped someone go to town.
Did he? So it was... Oh, yes, it was the director of Mr. Deeds Goes to Town.
Yes, that's the one, that's the one.
Yes. So, Frank Capra.
Well done. It was Frank Capra, the director of films such as Arsenic and Old Lace, and It Happened One Night. Miles, who is stating the case for the Irish people here?
Well, when I say you don't understand the Irish people, I don't really mean that they've got two heads or something. We're a very ordinary people. And when I say we're a simple people, I don't mean that in any derogatory sense, but we see things in uncomplicated ways.
So, who is speaking on behalf of the Irish people there?
Well, for a long time, the only famous Irish woman was Bernadette Devlin, but...
You are right, sir. It's Bernadette Devlin. Good. She was only 21 when she was elected as an MP to Westminster in 1969, but was a fiery orator and won the Mid-Ulster constituency despite a concerted unionist attempt to beat her. Polly, your turn now. Please identify, if you will, this perfectionist.
You never worry about perfection because you never arrive of perfection. Perfection never happens. There is plenty of possibilities of accidents. Stimulating and creative accidents.
Well, he had a rotten gram deck, but apart from that, who was it? It's an old recording.
It sounds Spanish.
Yes.
Yes. And a painter.
Yes.
Yes. Now, which of them? That's the question. I think I'll go for Dali.
You're right.
Yes. I wasn't sure.
Well, there wasn't much clue there, but you picked it all out very neatly. It was Salvador Dali, the surrealist artist. His life was art, and he's possibly the only artist to have turned his own moustache into an artistic monument. Fred, will you please listen to this and identify the serial artist?
I have to do the painting because I know it's like the criminal says, I have a need to kill, but I think it's much more acceptable to dip a little watercolour on a piece of paper than... go out gunning down people, you see.
Did you say serial painter?
Serial artist.
This is not Roy Lichtenstein, is it?
No. The fact that he's talking about painting is deliberately there to make your life a misery. It's got nothing to do with painting.
Oh, thanks. Come around and tosh my garage. Serial. No.
Something funny happened on the way to the forum, but not a British one?
In the forum, Zero Mostel was one of them.
Zero Mostel! Yeah. It was Zero Mostel, the American comic actor and star of Mel Brooks' The Producers, and a funny thing happened on the way to the forum. For a bonus point, Please listen to this.
No, I'm a little left of right of center. Get me in the right place. You got me a little bit too far over. I'm left of right of the middle of center. Any fee will get me over to the other side. I believe in government by corruption.
Oh, that was Ira Mostel as well, of course. How did that kind of attitude get him into trouble? It's rather free thinking for the time he lived in.
An American Activities again, was it?
That's right.
Dear old McCarthy. He was a comedian too. No, he didn't know it.
It's true. He got into trouble because his leftist leaning saw him blackballed during McCarthy's witch hunts of the 50s. Our next round's all about pseudonyms. From the nicknames, pen names, or even original names of some famous personalities, our panellists will have to tell me the names under which those people found fame and fortune. Francis, who might be cooking up a storm with the nickname Little Beaver? Cooking up a storm.
Cooking, yes. I don't think Fanny Craddock was ever known as Little Beaver, and I'm sure no one would dare say anything of the kind to Delia Smith. So my colleague here is going to tell me the answer, but he isn't. Cooking up a storm with the nickname of Little Beaver. Somebody
it's
nicknamed
called Little Beaver because he's very hyperactive.
Well, that's true of most television cooks. I mean, are we talking modern cooks?
Yes, we are.
The Galloping Gourmet generation, that sort of thing.
He's more upmarket than that and a man for all seasons.
Well, Marco Pierre White runs a restaurant, runs umpteen restaurants, but I think one of them is at the Four Seasons Hotel, isn't it? But he's not hyperactive, he's just rather violent.
Throws you out
all the all right, I give up, you tell me.
It's Raymond Blanc, the chef and restaurateur, because he does run Le Manoir aux Quatre Saisons.
He does indeed. Just down the road from you, I believe, Martin, isn't it?
That's almost our local gaff, really.
That's what I think.
Miles, what or rather who was Darwin's bulldog?
Darwin's bulldog.
Who was Darwin's bulldog?
Francis is looking in the other direction, which is always a bad sign. Huxley, T.H. Huxley.
Yes, well done, that's very good.
He was the only Victorian Darwinist I could think of. So. Well,
the next clue, which would have lost you a point, but you certainly won all two there, his grandson discovered a brave new world. So absolutely right. It was the biologist Thomas Huxley. He was known as Darwin's bulldog because of the way he defended Darwin's theories. But for a bonus point, can anyone tell me to whom he made the following riposte? A man has no reason to be ashamed of having an ape for his grandfather. If there were an ancestor whom I should feel shame in recalling, it would rather be a man who, not content with an equivocal success in his own sphere of activity, plunges into scientific questions with which he has no real acquaintance. Well, it's very elegant and literary.
What a snappy rejoinder.
Yes. 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 Repartee.
Well, was it when Disraeli said, I'm on the side of the angels?
That deserves a point, but it's not true.
Was it Cardinal Newman?
No, that's not bad either.
Bishop of Oxford?
You're right, Fred. Well done. A bonus point for two intelligent suggestions and a bonus point for getting it right. He said that to Bishop Samuel Wilberforce during a debate in Oxford in 1860.
Soapy Sam. Did you know that Darwin, Karl Marx wanted to dedicate Das Kapital to Darwin? And when it came out, he sent him a copy and said, I hope you'll read this. I'm a great fan of yours, Origin of Species. And he got a polite letter back from Darwin saying, thank you so much, Mr. Marx. And Marx took this as a fan letter in return and went round boasting, saying, oh, Darwin's a great admirer of mine. You know, he's read my book from end to end. He thinks it's wonderful simply because he'd sent him a polite, formal letter. And if you go down to Knowle House in Kent, you can still see the copy of Das Kapital that Karl Marx sent Darwin. And the pages are still uncut. And Marx went to his grave not realising that Darwin hadn't the faintest idea who he was and had no interest in reading his bloody book.
Polly, why might you want to back a man with the nickname Longfellow?
Back a man, yes. Might be a man who's spent a bit of time inside at one point. Mm-hmm. Yes, might be. A very small man. Mm-hmm. This is Lester Pigott?
It is Lester Pigott.
Right.
And you said a very small man, but he was actually dubbed Longfellow because he's tall for a jockey at 5'7½". He rode his first winner at the age of 12 and after a successful career made a comeback at the age of 55 and won the 2,000 guineas at Newmarket, which he immediately gave directly to the taxman. If you were to ask David White for his autograph, Fred, what would he write, David White?
David White. See, I knew it. Every time he comes round to me, I'm dead.
If you were lucky, he might sell you some perfume. Cheap stuff, of course, from a suitcase.
From a suitcase? Oh, not David Jason.
It is David Jason. He's the son of a Billingsgate fish porter, and he was an electrician before he became an actor. He took his surname from his favourite film, Jason and the Argonauts. That's why he called himself David Argonauts. Right, at the end of that round, let's have a look at the scores. Fred and Polly have got 5. Francis and Miles have got 9. Our next round is entitled Curriculum Vitae. We've put together some unorthodox CVs detailing the less well-known facts from the lives of 4 famous luminaries. All our panellists have to do is identify the person from the description. I shall read out each of the 4 facts, and the sooner you answer, the more points you get. Francis, our first person was born in 1946. Her father was a NATO colonel who sent her to school in France and banned her from taking singing lessons because he felt they were too frivolous. At the age of 16, she ran away to Madrid, but was brought back by her father, who enrolled her in an English secretarial college.
Would this be Marianne Faithfull?
No, but you're in the right neck of the woods. She rebelled again, became a model, and then an actress.
Oh, Twiggy. No, she wasn't.
Nope.
Daughter of an
she shocked 60s London by revealing that she was living in a ménage à trois with her manager, Brian Southcombe, and a male model.
You're on your own, Francis.
Please could you not let your mouths gape open when I'm asking the questions? Yes. Her screen roles have been no less shocking, and her sexy screen style was probably put to its greatest use in The Night Porter.
Oh, it's Charlotte Rampling.
That's correct. For which you get...
It was the male model that threw me. I didn't remember that little interlude. Must have been before my time, I think.
It is the 60s wild child, Charlotte Rampling. She starred opposite such greats as Paul Newman and Dirk Bogarde, who realised her great screen presence at once, saying, when she's on screen, it's almost impossible to look at anyone else. Except the male model, of course, I suppose. Miles, it's your turn now. Can you work out whose CV this is? Born in 1942, he was brought up in Brighton and went to Varndean Grammar School and then to Brighton Business College. He spent 6 years working as an insurance salesman before beginning his broadcasting career with BBC Radio Brighton. After a number of years, mainly doing boxing commentaries, he went to TV and joined Nationwide's Friday Night Sports coverage, which I was on. So I know the answer.
Brighton Business College, boxing, Nationwide.
If only I'd watched all these programmes, gosh.
Now he is Britain's number one sports anchorman and leaves his rivals wondering, how does he do that?
Well, now we know, don't we? Miles doesn't watch television. He lives in a place where you can't pick it up. He lives in such a remote hamlet that they don't actually have transmitters and aerials. It's Des Lynam.
It is Des Lynam. It is Des Lynam, the silver-haired and silver-tongued smoothie of sports commentary. For a bonus point, can anyone remember what he said after Gareth Southgate missed the penalty against Germany in the 1996 European Championship?
It wasn't oh dear, was it?
It wasn't oh dear, and it wasn't anything much worse, because he's a good broadcaster. He said, you can come out from behind your sofas now. Polly, our next person was born at Sharpham Park near Glastonbury and was educated at Eton. He moved to London in the late 1720s. A disputed inheritance left him short of money, and he supported himself as a playwright and satirist. In fact, his searing attacks on Sir Robert Walpole prompted the introduction of the Theatrical Licensing Act of 1737.
Well, I'm very bad on those playwrights. Would it be Sheridan?
No. He became a Justice of the Peace and on one occasion wrote a pamphlet which demanded that the poet laureate, Colley Cibber, be tried for murder of the English language.
Fielding?
Do you write a play?
It was Henry
Fielding.
Oh,
good.
My friend.
The author, of course, of Tom Jones, that book scandalised the London literati when it was published. Dr. Johnson disliked it, and some critics even held it responsible for two earth tremors that shook London after its publication. Fred, the last CV goes to you. He was born in Brixton in 1947, the son of a wrestling club manager and a cinema usherette. While working as an advertising copy clerk, he wrote to the washing machine tycoon, John Bloom, remember him, mm-hmm. asking him for financial backing for his music career. When that career did eventually start, it almost stopped at once because his first two singles for EMI with his bands The Mannish Boys and The Lower Third were flops.
This is Pete Townsend?
No. Yeah,
it's one of the Who, though, isn't it?
No.
The Mannish Boys?
And The Lower Third. Apparently they were dreadful.
Yeah.
His early songs detail the antics of things like Laughing Gnome.
Oh, yeah, that's David Jones. That's Ziggy Stardust.
That's right.
I can't think of life of me think of his name.
We'll settle for the one.
David Bowie. Here, David Bowie.
It's David Bowie. Well done, Fred. Now it's time for a musical round. Each of you will hear a piece of music which is either about, written for, dedicated to, or otherwise connected with a famous person. All I want to know is, who is that person? Francis, feast your ears on this. That was a band called The Adverts, singing Gary Gilmore's Eyes. I think we understood that after we'd heard it six times. But who was Gary Gilmore?
Well, he was an American murderer who is mainly remembered now, not for his crime, but for the manner of his death, because he was executed. And Norman Mailer wrote a colossal book about him called The Executioner's Song, which means that he's one of the most famous people in America now, simply for having been executed while Norman Mailer was... covering it.
Well, I have to say, I'm now throwing away two pages of the script because you've answered that so completely. That was first class. Well done. Miles, here's a piece of music for you. Can you tell me for whom this piece was written? The answer isn't Melvin Bragg.
it's the Lloyd Webber brothers, isn't it?
It is.
Julian playing the cello, rather scrapely, I thought. But, his brother didn't write that bit. It was Paganini who wrote that bit.
His brother had a little sort of tinkle
yes,
with it.
Yes.
That's right, well done. Yeah, The Variations for Cello, based on the theme of Paganini, as you quite rightly said, were written for Andrew Lloyd Webber's brother Julian. To complete a thoroughly musical family, their late father William was a brilliant organist, choirmaster, and director of the Royal College of Music, and their mother was a piano teacher. Polly, here's a piece of music for you. Music knows it is and always will be one of the things that life just won't quit. But here's some of music's pioneers. Now, first of all, can you tell me who that was, Polly?
Well, we over here think it might be Stevie Wonder.
It is Stevie Wonder. That's good.
Right.
Now...
But I couldn't hear what he was saying.
Well, that's modern music for you, isn't it? Yes, the song was written in tribute to another great black American musician. If you know the name of the song, you're nearly all the way there. It was actually in that clip, but I agree, difficult to hear.
Was it for somebody blind?
Nope.
Oh. Well, it wasn't Ray Charles then.
Oscar Peterson?
He's Canadian.
We go through them all, yeah, why? Let's go.
We haven't got all night.
He's not named in the song, is he, this person?
Mm-hmm. He's named in the song, if you listen very carefully, and I've only heard it seven times, you heard it once, Sir Duke, the song is called.
Duke Ellington.
Duke Ellington.
Duke Ellington, that's right. Born Edward Kennedy Ellington in 1899, Duke was one of the greatest jazzmen of his generation. On his 70th birthday, he received the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Nixon, and such was his international appeal that he even featured on a postage stamp in the African Republic of Togo. Fred, here's your piece of music. We had that in specially as a tribute to you, Fred.
It was written for my christening.
I thought so. Who started an upstanding tradition with that piece of music?
It's one of the Georges, and I always get them mixed up.
It is one of the Georges.
Let's have a look. It's George II.
It is George II. Can you tell us why it began the upstanding tradition?
Well, he actually was so pleased by it. The official version was he stood up. The reality was he'd been sitting there for 3.5 hours, and you know what happens to your bladder when that happens.
He was on his way to the loo, wasn't
he? That's it.
During the Messiah's London premiere, he reportedly rose to his feet, King George II, to acclaim the Hallelujah chorus, and the rest of the audience followed suit. Well, he was the king. I think it's time we had an update on the scores. I see that Fred and Polly have 16, Francis and Miles have 18. Of all the subjects that the great and the good discuss, there's one subject on which they all have a lot to say, themselves. This is our autobiography round. I'll read some quotes from famous people about themselves. All our teams have to do is identify who is being introspective. Francis, listen to this. I just cover myself with a tent and only expose my wrists and ankles, which are exquisite. One advantage of being fat is that you are less likely to get mugged. Muggers are cowards and go for the littlies. Who is the person scaring muggers with her tent-wearing antics?
Well, it's obviously a modern autobiography.
Yes.
By someone with a fuller figure.
Extremely fuller figure, yes.
Not one of the funny people like Hermione Gingold, is it?
It's probably, yeah, but or more recently, it's probably one of those Joe Brand-type figures, or actually...
Yes.
Jennifer Patterson and Clarissa Dixon Wright in the same dress.
That's right. Well done.
Is it?
Well done. It was Jennifer Patterson, one of the sizzling duo, the two fat ladies, the other, as you said, being Clarissa Dixon Wright. Jennifer was brought up in pre-communist China, but has never had a cookery lesson in her life. I assume that explains something, but I don't know what. Miles, who is giving an interesting description of themselves here? This is quite hard. A lively little creature with long legs and arms. A spider is no ill emblem of him. He has been taken at a distance for a small windmill.
Is someone talking about himself?
Yes.
In the third person?
Well, they're very strange, these satirists.
Uh-huh. Is it Jonathan Swift?
No, but you're very nearly there. He was no dunce, but he wrote a satire on dullness.
Alexander Pope.
Correct, wrote the Dunciad. Well done. Right, Polly, who is the quiet introvert describing herself here? I don't smoke. I don't drink to speak of. I don't take drugs at all. I take care of my two children. I've been married twice, once for 11 years and once for 3. I don't go out with more than one man at a time. But you know what it is? I dress strangely.
It sounds like Barbara Cartland, doesn't it?
So this is somebody we would expect to be very wild and debauched and is claiming not to be.
That's correct.
Yes, right. This is somebody of sort of our times.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
Cher, yes, and Sonny and Cher.
Oh, Cher.
It is.
Really?
Cher.
Well, I never.
Fred, who made this rather poetic observation about himself? The colour of my soul is iron grey, and sad bats wheel about the steeple of my dreams.
William Blake?
Very good suggestion. Not a poet, but he was inspired by the poet Mallarmé to do a composition of his own.
Oh. Not Britain.
No, and French, not British.
French.
Debussy?
Debussy is correct. Our last round is called Claim to Fame and deals with people whose fame was fleeting. Our panellists need merely to tell me who the fame seekers were or why they gained their nugget of fame. So, Francis, can you tell me the claim to fame of the Wild West outlaw, Robert Ford?
Robert Ford.
We're good on the Wild West.
Well, it was...
Oh. Did he shoot somebody more famous than himself?
Mm-hmm.
Like Jesse James?
Yes, he did shoot Jesse James. Robert Ford had been a member of the notorious James Gang, who committed numerous train and bank robberies in a 15-year crime spree. But when a very large reward was put on Jesse James's head, Ford just couldn't resist the temptation. Money, money, money. Miles, how did Charles Dawson fiddle his way to fame?
Charles Dawson.
He made some old bones out of it.
We know.
Well, then you must tell us.
He's the man who forged the Piltdown Man.
Correct!
Yes.
Fred, Mary Surratt found fame, but probably would have traded it for historical obscurity. Why would she have done that?
Sorry, Mary who?
Surratt, S-U-R-R-A-T-T, Surratt.
Mary Surratt. Would have found fame, but didn't want it.
He didn't want it.
Mary Surratt.
It's got something to do with a man who was unhappy on finding a booth in a theatre.
Oh, this is, booth is John Wilkes Booth, and this is Abraham Lincoln. What was Mary Surratt? Was she on the stage at the time?
No, she was
really hanged. Ruined the second act.
She was hanged as one of the conspirators in the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. For a bonus point, can anyone tell me what links John Wilkes Booth, Abraham Lincoln and Mudd?
Mudd, Dr. Mudd. Yeah.
And what about him?
Well, he was the doctor who attended to the injuries and was accused of participation in the plot, of conspiring with Booth, and therefore his name was Mudd.
That's right. That's where we get the expression. Thank you all very much indeed. The end of that round also brings us to the end of the show, and it's been very, very close. A glance at the scores tells me that Fred and Polly have 23, but Francis and Miles have just got ahead of them with 24. So, all I have to do now is to thank our panellists, Francis Wheen, Miles Kington, Polly Toynbee, and Fred Housegrove.